The Tom Woods Show, episode 862.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, if you love to read, and I know you do, I've got some excellent libertarian ebooks for you that are absolutely free and that will help you make the case more effectively. Check them out at tomsfreebooks.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here, talking today about the phenomenon known as the alt-right, and we're talking about it with a man who knows all different shades and stripes of the right like the back of his hand, and that's Paul Gottfried, who is formerly professor of humanities at Elizabethtown College. He was also a Guggenheim recipient. He holds a PhD from Yale University, and he's the author of numerous books, including Conservatism in America, The Strange Death of Marxism, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt, and Fascism, the Career of a Concept. We'll be linking to several of those on the show notes page, as well as to my previous conversations with Paul Gottfried at tomwoods.com/862. Paul, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me on again.
I would like to talk today a little bit about something called the alt-right, and you have been called the godfather of the alt-right, which is a not necessarily super descriptive term here, so we want to get to the bottom of that. I want to know how you would describe the alt-right. And secondly, there have been dissenters from mainstream, boring American conservatism for many years that thought of themselves as an alternative right without necessarily being what we today call the alt-right. Is there any way you can sort out the terminology?
Yeah, you know, I as I mentioned to you before, Tom, I was interested until, you know, I discovered I couldn't find a commercial press for this, in doing a book on the alt-right in which I would make all of the distinctions that you mentioned. I think there was an alternative right or a non-aligned right. There still is a non-aligned right consisting of people who in some cases go back to the paleoconservative attack or resistance to the neoconservative takeover in the 1980s, and, you know, that included paleo-libertarians and paleo-conservatives. And those of us who are still around, I suppose, are part of a disaligned right or an alternative right. The alt-right, I think, is a different phenomenon, and it develops, I think, among a younger generation. And I'm not sure it's a particularly coherent whole, and I think here I would have to agree with Christopher Caldwell, who wrote a piece on this in the New York Times. Caldwell obviously was interested in disparaging the alt-right, since he himself is a fixture of the conservative movement by now. But I think Caldwell is correct that you're dealing with, you know, fragmented dissenters on the right who are not really united by a shared worldview, but who share a common hostility to the conservative movement, and have been largely empowered through the internet. And, you know, I think that description is good. There are different groups that identify themselves as the alt-right. I think I think the term may have been invented by a friend of mine, Richard Spencer, who back around 2008 or 2009 took a term that I had used, and which I think he may have used before, the alternative right, and then turned it into the alt-right. But then under his supervision, the term came to mean something very different from what I had in mind. And then, you know, the use of the term became more widespread. And I think at one point, Breitbart and Steve Bannon took it over, and they identify themselves as the alt-right. I don't know whether they're still using that term because it has come under fire from the liberal establishment. And if you, as you know, the attacks on the alt-right were used by Hillary Clinton during her campaign.
Right, which was a completely idiotic thing to do.
Right.
99% of the public never even heard of the alt-right.
Exactly.
And really idiotic. And she learned nothing from Rudy Giuliani attacking Ron Paul. What's the matter with her?
Yeah.
All right. then let's talk about you in particular. When you say you were in effect, searching for an alternative to the modern right.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that you'd want an alternative to? What was wrong with it in the first place?
Well, okay, the alternative, which paleoconservatives and paleolibertarians were concerned with, going all the way back to the 1980s and in some cases to the 1950s, was the growing influence of really what were Cold War liberals on the conservative movement. People who were essentially Humphrey, Scoop Jackson Democrats, who believed in a large centralized welfare state, who supported social engineering by the government for the purpose of removing discrimination, and who were committed to successive crusades for American democracy through the world, in other words, Wilsonians or neo-Wilsonians. And I think the opposition to these positions crystallized, if I may use the double entendre, quite early, in the mid 1980s, it was there. And you have a paleoconservative, paleolibertarian alliance, which into the 1990s, one which your mentor Murray Rothbard was influential in bringing about. I think that the opposition from the right to the leftward drift of the conservative movement has been there all along, throughout the post-war years. And if you go back into the 1970s, you discover that National Review is beginning to move to the left. What I think is different in the case of the alt-right is the nature of the revolt. I mean, they're not rebelling in the name of an older America, American constitutional principles, limited government. They seem in some ways to be an imitation, at least the extreme elements within the alt-right, the ones that I think have now become dominant since Breitbart, I think, may be moving away from that term. They seem to be heavily influenced by interwar right-wing authoritarian movements. They seem to like them a great deal. And then at the very fringe, you sort of get white nationalists, although I think their influence on the alt-right has probably been exaggerated, but they are there.
But that's what people think when they hear the term alt-right.
Right, exactly, because they are there. But, I think they basically served as a kind of whipping boy or target for, articles in The Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post. Most of these attacks come from people who are trying to link the alt-right as a white nationalist movement with Donald Trump and his presidency.
I'm interested in the right in general. I have been for a long time.
Right.
The first academic paper I ever gave was on the conservative movement back in 96. Princeton University had a conference on the conservative movement.
Right.
And since nobody knows anything about the conservative movement, it was easy for me to get in and to do that, right? So I've been interested in this all along. So, of course, I'm going to follow what's going on and the splits in the right. These things fascinate me. So I have tried to keep up with what the different components of what we might call the alt-right have been saying. And,
right.
And what's interesting to me is that there are times that I say, look, this is a reasonable point. For example, if they say the idea of a propositional nation is just silly, it contradicts
yes, it
everyday
yes.
experience. People don't just say, "Well, I'm going to be an empty vessel filled with nothing but abstract principles." People don't actually live that way, it turns out.
Right.
And instead,
right.
when you bring all these disparate groups together, instead of them all pledging allegiance to abstract principles, they still, as it turns out, remain loyal to their in-group, and they
mm-hmm.
they take that loyalty and they push it. They try to push the state in their direction, and you wind up with a bunch of squabbling tribes. You don't wind up with a group of people platonically committed to abstract principles. It does not happen.
No,
and so
no.
that I think is quite a reasonable point. But on the other hand, then I look more closely, and a lot of the people associated with the alt-right will say things like they're basically okay with things like the welfare state. The problem is the blacks have wrecked it for everybody.
Right.
But if we
right.
had a place like Sweden, we could have a nice welfare state. It wouldn't be a problem. Whereas my view is, I guess, probably closer to the traditional conservative view, which is that the welfare state deforms everybody,
right.
and it leads to pathologies among everybody. So if I were somebody who thought that the interests of the white race must predominate, the last thing in the world I would want would be a welfare state.
Yes, yes. No, no, I think you are absolutely correct, but I think this may show the shadow cast on at least elements of the alt-right by interwar right-wing authoritarian movements. And as the author of a book on fascism, I can recognize the Gestalt. But, you know, I think you're absolutely correct that there is this, you know, combination of perfectly sensible views with positions that seem to us almost grotesque, or some kind of attempt to reprise a not very successful interwar European experience. But I think, you know, one way that we can conceptualize what is happening with the alt-right, and one that I've tried to do in some of my articles, is to point out that there has been a series of purges in which the conservative movement has been engaging in for many decades. And Jonah Goldberg, who I think probably embodies all the things that we despise most about a degenerate conservative movement, speaks about this happily, you know, as a successful removal of certain people from the bus of conservatism. They had to just be thrown off the bus. Okay, well, it sort of starts early, the people who are thrown off get misrepresented. A lot of them are Jewish libertarians, like Murray Rothbard, Ron Hamowy. They get kicked off. But then they are going to be surrealistically depicted as anti-Semites to fit into the narrative that is created in the 1970s or 1980s, conservative narrative, the neoconservative narrative. Then you have other people thrown out, like the John Birch Society, not for the reasons that we are given, because they're extremist or racist. They're not racist or anti-Semites. They do have a wacky theory of communist conspiracy. But their real offense, and if you go back to National Review in the 1960s, they tell you this, they opposed the war in Vietnam.
Right.
That is why the National Review denounces the John Birch Society. But again, that's an inconvenient narrative, particularly if you're appealing to friends on the left. So you have to say they were anti-Semites.
Right. And of course, the John Birch Society, as far as I could see, they were all Zionists.
Yes, they were. And many were Jews, and some were blacks. But, you know, none of this fits the narrative that, you know, is created after the fact. So you have lots and lots of people who got thrown out of the conservative movement. I was thrown out of the conservative. Murray Rothbard was thrown out. Tom Fleming, a whole bunch of other people got tossed out. We don't necessarily all agree on issues, but we all got thrown out for various offenses. And I think the alt-right that we see are simply, you know, made up of other people who were thrown out or see themselves as thrown out. But they don't even recognize the conservative movement anymore. They simply say that these were just a bunch of leftists pretending to be on the right, and they were addressing false issues. So, the people on the alt-right say, we shouldn't be opposing gay marriage. Why bother with this? We have to defend the white race. Or something like, and you know, I hear this from the extremes.
But on the other hand, I hear some other alt-right people saying that the whole homosexual rights movement is just open degeneracy that is corrupting the white race. So
yes,
we want to be against it.
Right, right, exactly. But the ultimate criterion for what's good or bad is the preservation of the white race among the white nationalist elements.
All right, but stop right there. Somebody might legitimately say, given that every other race on Earth sees no problem with trying to preserve itself, they'll say,
right,
Paul Gottfried, you're Jewish. Of course you're going to say it's not important to preserve the white race. I'm just trying to anticipate
what
somebody might say. So what would you say?
Well, I'm not against preserving the white race. I am against an ideology which features white nationalism, A, because it is not going to hold together the right. It's ridiculous. Whites have never been white nationalists. It's an artificial ideology like black nationalism, but one that's not going to be as successful because it faces the opposition of the entire media. Second of all, the real problem is to combat the people who hate the white race or hate whites or hate white Christians. These people have to be fought tooth and nail, and creating a white nationalist movement is a diversion from the real war that we're engaged in. Against the multicultural left and against the supporters of a large government intended to implement the teachings or positions of the multicultural left. So I think it's a diversion from what has to be done. And then at the end, I think you're going to have to include blacks in your movement of resistance. You know, you're not dealing with 10 or 20 people. You're dealing with millions of people by now. So I just think the white nationalist position has absolutely no future, and brings with it all kinds of social and media problems.
Now, let me play devil's advocate again. See, people in the alt-right could say, look, Paul, you are from yesteryear. The fact is, in a very short time, we've made CPAC scared of us. They have to denounce us at CPAC.
Right.
We have to be denounced in all the official channels. Obviously, we are on the move, despite the fact that we're breaking all the rules, but possibly because we're breaking all the rules, because we're being impolite, because we're just breaking down barriers and speaking frankly.
Right.
And so maybe
right.
we don't want to hear what a paleo from the 1990s has to say to us, because that never got us anywhere. We got to try something new.
Right. No, I think they have a point. The paleos went nowhere. They were totally marginalized by the neoconservatives, and they took over the conservative movement. The problem is that the white nationalists are also not going anywhere. They're simply a bugaboo, or by now a whipping boy, of the left. The only reason they are even on the political horizon is they're useful for the left as a means of associating the entire conservative or the entire right with white nationalists. They serve demonological purpose for the left. Meanwhile, everyone else right of center is trying to avoid them. And from what I can tell, they do not control resources. They have the internet. They don't have a television station. They don't have widely distributed magazines. They are as isolated as the paleos were it not for the fact that they serve this demonological purpose, and they are means by which the left can associate the entire right with white nationalism.
Let's get back to the point about interwar authoritarianism.
Right.
The argument that I've heard from a lot of people is, what we are seeing before us now from the left proves that these people are so toxic, you can't share a society with them at all. They will always be trying to eat away at it from within.
Right.
Therefore, we need outright repression of these people at the very least, because, and you may say that's crazy and unrealistic, but they'll say equally crazy and unrealistic is sharing a society with the left.
Yeah, the problem with this is there is an attempt to identify the current, when I say white nationalists, who are probably a minority within the alt-right, with a force that was as powerful as Nazism. We're not even going to talk about the Italian fascists, who I are. I argue that in my book on fascism, generic fascists are almost a kind of sideshow in European history. But, you know, you have to remember the Nazis got tens of millions of votes in 1931 when they were really hitting their stride. They got, like, you know, 33-34% of the votes for the German Reichstag. They won 40% of the vote in the last presidential race before the Nazis took over, the one that was which Hitler ran against Hindenburg. The white nationalists in America are a totally marginalized force. They do not begin to compare in power with the left that is now engaging in violent protest in the United States. We in the United States do not have a problem, you know, of right-wing racists taking over the country. We have a problem of black nationalists allied to crazy white people who have become a danger. And what they're trying to do is totally destroy their opposition. So our danger is coming from a very different quarter from the one that brought down the Weimar Republic.
What then do you think dissidents should be doing? People who just can't stand the official platitudes of the American right, but clearly are on the right or certainly are not on the left. What should we be doing? I mean, we publish all the books you can publish. I mean, we've made
right.
all the arguments you can make. We've
right.
we've done all this stuff. We've held the conferences. And I think the alt-right is saying, given that we've done all that, maybe it's time to be extremely provocative. And that way we reach out to people who feel marginalized, but then they see how provocative and bold we are. And they say, yeah, that's where I want to be.
Okay, I think the first thing we have to do, and I think we share most of the same political views, the first thing we have to do is somehow get hold of the resources that are available to the to members of the fake conservative movement. And they have behind them, you know, major financial sources. They have behind them corporate wealth. Because there's nothing that they say that is really inconsistent with the interest of, or with the interest of large corporations. They also have behind them, Republican benefactors with strong Zionist views, because they strongly support the Israeli right. I don't know how we can get hold of such resources, but there's no way that we can really improve our game until we have them. Because we really can't compete against against Fox News. It's hard for us to compete against National Review, even the Weekly Standard. I mean, these people belong to, one might say, a kind of network of association that we don't have. Somebody writing for National Review will be put on Fox News, who will then be offered, you know, contracts by major publishing houses. It's very clear that we don't have these resources. A few weeks ago, I was on a program featured by the Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and I was there with Ben Dominic and somebody from the Wall Street Journal, from the New Yorker. Well, I have to tell you, what impressed me about that company was they had all kinds of contacts. And they were going to pick up $1,000 for appearing, at least one of us pay that for coming to the participating in the conference in Philadelphia. But they were going to go to three or four more conferences in the next day, where they'd also pick up, you know, large honoraria. And then they were going to be on television the following night. Now, we do not have these accesses that they do.
That's true. But on the other hand, one thing that we haven't figured out how to exploit yet, but that we do have, is that no 25-year-old reads National Review. It just seems to me that's my instinct.
Right.
And no 25-year-old reads a Weekly Standard. So they're sitting there waiting to be influenced, because they certainly know they don't belong to these stuffed shirts.
Right, right.
What can we do with that?
Well, first we have to get hold of a television channel. I mean this seriously, because, you know, we have millions of people who watch television, as opposed to the people who come, you know, the relatively small number who go to Lou Rockwell Scholars Conference, and we are dealing with scales of size in terms of being able to influence the public. And someone like Lou does well raising money. That's true. The other people, though, have, you know, 100 times as much money at their disposal. Also, the liberal media are not as hostile to neoconservatives or moderate Republicans or even the people on Fox as they would be to us, because I think we represent much more of an ideological and programmatic challenge.
Yeah, there's no question about that. All right, let me just think out loud here for a minute. As I say, I think the alt-right is a more diverse group of people than the media gives them credit for. As I said, I hear people who favor the welfare state and they want environmentalism because the stupid conservatives who support the free market allegedly don't care about the environment. I mean, it's a lot of it is sadly predictable, and it's not at all something that I'd be interested in. But it is a diverse group, because I also find anarcho-capitalists who consider themselves alt-right. And I know this isn't the fundamental aspect of it, but I just don't see how you can say, I'm defending Western civilization, I'm defending everything that is good and noble about it, while at the same time, just to be cheeky and provocative, you understand, I'm going to joke about throwing Jews into ovens, and I'm going to joke about murdering people. That's what's best and noble about Western civilization to you? I mean, you've studied thousands of years of Western civilization, and that's what you've come up with? And could you imagine the great men of Western civilization thinking that was in any way acceptable, even for purposes of cheekiness? I guess we belong to two different civilizations then.
No, I entirely agree with you. I think this may be, you know, the attempt to respond to neoconservative platitudes about propositional nationhood, and the attempt, which you get on Fox News every day, to identify Western civilization with the current state of American democracy. Gay rights, I mean, they hear attacks on Putin because he doesn't recognize gay rights sufficiently. Or there was one person writing in National Review suggesting that we shouldn't abandon the Ukrainian transgendered. So, I mean, the problem is the notion of Western civilization, which has now become identified with propositional nationhood and gay rights and feminism or moderate feminism or whichever, you know, is the topic du jour. This has become, you know, such a ridiculous caricature of civilization that you get other people now who call themselves radical traditionalists who have even less, you know, less of a sense of Western civilization. You have to remember that the extreme on the alt-right refer to themselves as radical traditionalists, which means they're not traditionalists at all. You know, they're just radicals. And I suppose in this way, they're sort of imitating interwar fascists who, you know, also sometimes said they were traditionalists but were radicals of a different kind. But I do agree with you that this attempt to outrage, you know, épater la bourgeoisie has become sort of ridiculous, and has destroyed whatever credibility these people in the alt-right might otherwise have.
So the situation, though, as you paint it, is pretty grim. I mean, you're
saying that there
really isn't a whole lot that we can do other than hope that a sugar daddy comes through someday down the road and helps to subsidize some kind of a media enterprise. So I think the alt-right would say, look, we're a little bit too impatient for that. So we're going to take matters into our own hands. We're going to be clumsy and clunky and impolite, and we're going to break all the rules. But it's getting us attention and it's getting us more followers. So it seems like better than sitting around doing nothing. I think that's what they would say.
Yeah, but of course what they're doing is isolating themselves more and more. By the way, you know, my position is not that the only thing we need is a sugar daddy, but, you know, I think we do need some sugar daddies in order to make our position known to, you know, millions of people and to be able to compete against the conservative establishment. The lack of resources can be ruinous. And in the case of the alt-right, I mean, their resources are basically the internet, except for Breitbart. And I'm not sure I would characterize Breitbart any longer as belonging to the alt-right. You know, when I was planning to do this book on the alt-right, I contacted the person who was in charge of Breitbart. The name was given to me. The person never got back to me. And it was explained to me that the people at Breitbart do not want to use the term alt-right anymore. They've moved away from it. So, you know, even the term is becoming toxic by now, as I found out when I tried to write a book on the subject.
Well, also, it's a difficult term to, you know, I understand the idea that we want an alternative to, we need a strong national defense and family values. I mean, you know, come on now. I mean, enough's enough with that stuff.
Yeah.
I get that you want an alternative to that, but just to call your movement the alternative right, when there are many alternatives,
right,
and there are many people who are unhappy with the official right,
right,
it would be very hard to narrow it down and say, well, this is the one alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you wind up with this confusion where Breitbart obviously is an alternative, but it doesn't want to be that alternative, so now it doesn't know what to call itself.
No, I think that's true. And if you notice, until Milo Yiannopoulos disgraced himself forever, there was an attempt to feature him on Fox News. I saw him there several times, and some of the writers for Breitbart are now appear on Fox News. So they have the problem that they may be coming just mainstream, and this may have been the result of a very deliberate decision not to be associated with the alt-right any longer because the term had become toxic.
Well, and this is what I fear, by the way, if there really were a television channel that reflected our ideas, One thing we are not good at is keeping control of our organizations out of the hands of bad people. You know, I mean, before
right.
within 10 years, it'll be talking about the propositional nation, or our
right.
people will feel like for instance, I would go to events sponsored by Liberty Fund.
Right.
Now, Liberty Fund is mainstream libertarian,
mm-hmm.
but they have Pierre Goodrich's money, and they hold these little scholarly symposia. You've probably
right.
I may even have seen you at one for all I know, but anyway. What they'll do is they'll bring people sometimes from the left and the center, and then they'll bring them into these events.
Right.
Nobody on the left or the center says, let's bring libertarians. And no one.
No,
that does not happen.
No.
But that side always feels like, well, you know, we have to be ecumenical and reach out. And I could just see that. I would hate the programming decisions made. It would be like the frustration I felt watching certain presidential campaigns unfold. I said, why are they making this ridiculous decision?
Yeah, I mean, also another thing that I find interesting or depressing about, you know, whom they reach out to is that these sort of mainstream libertarians or mainstream conservatives never reach out to the people on their right. They're only trying
never.
To conciliate.
No, those people don't exist. There are, those
no.
people are. That's why the mention of the alt-right at CPAC, I thought, was such an interesting watershed moment, because for a brief moment they admitted that there are other people out there.
Right, right.
How about that?
Other people who have been ostracized and have been marginalized and pushed out of the conservative movement, you know, and have not been recognized since, I don't know, the 1970s or 1980s. And, you know, this is something which I find very depressing, that mainstream conservatives will not engage in any kind of dialogue with people on their right. Even when I was in that program with Ben Dominic and the person from the Wall Street Journal, the conversation was pretty much confined, you know, to how we're going to work out an alternative to Obamacare, which, you know, sounds to me very much like Obamacare in the end. But, you know, the differences that are expressed operate within a very, very limited, within a very restricted parameter. And you just don't get, you know, serious alternatives that are being expressed, because there is an attempt to maintain harmonious relations or some kind of dialogue with the left. And the left, on the other hand, has no compunctions about inviting in the extreme left. And the extreme left becomes the left. The conservative movement is always looking at its left flank. That's the only thing that it notices, the only thing it's concerned about. And I might say that the one good thing that I associate with the alt-right is they have created a right flank of some kind that, you know, that is receiving notice. It may be the wrong kind of notice, but, you know, at least there is an awareness, you know, an increased awareness that there is something to the right of the official conservative movement.
Well, Paul, as you look at the landscape out there in terms of websites and organizations, where do you feel most at home right now?
Well, then I'm an old timer, so I feel comfortable with paleocons and paleolibertarians because they tend to be of my generation and have confronted the same historical problems and dealt with the same problem of being ostracized. I also recognize that, you know, my positions may seem archaic to people of a younger generation. I'm 75, you know, but I know my children and grandchildren think differently. But, you know, if you're asking me where I feel most comfortable, it is with, you know, people like myself. I am aware that there is a need for an alternative, a real alternative, you know, to what we now have. And it is an alternative that can only be successful, you know, if it is able to acquire the resources necessary to reach, you know, tens of millions of people, something that the official conservative movement has been able to do. I'm not sure that I will be part of that solution. But, you know, I've pretty much dedicated my life to describing the problem without being able to propose a solution.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. So, you know, people are going to have to think these issues through, and we're going to have to keep wrestling with them as to
right.
what can be done to get a dissident message out there. I mean, again, the internet is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But now, on the other hand, the Trump phenomenon shows that even though Trump is all confused, he's got tens of millions of Twitter followers that he could
mm-hmm.
use to
mm-hmm.
to short circuit the media. He's got he doesn't have to pay. He could stop holding press conferences tomorrow if he wanted to. He could just go directly to the people. What does he need these people for? He could do any of this. The Ron Paul success is also an right. example of how there is a latent anger out there. There is something out there. The fact that Trump got elected when every single respectable person told you not to vote for him tells you there's the root of something out there.
Right.
And it's just hard to know. You know, and meanwhile, the, you know, the think tanks in Washington are licking their chops to try to see how they can make a buck out of it.
Right. But I also think that the problem with Trump, there are many problems with him, but one problem that I see is that the neoconservatives and the official conservative movement and the so-called conservative think tanks will have no trouble taking him over. Because people like us are not going to be advising him. It is the ones who have media presence and have influence and who belong to the permanent Washington establishment who I think may get the upper hand with this dissident president. And unless we are able to acquire the means to make our views, you know, more widely known, we're not going to be able to exert anything like an equivalent influence to the one now being exerted by, I don't know, Newt Gingrich, Bill Bennett, who seems to be climbing to the top of the food chain again. So I think this does remain a perennial problem for our side, just gaining influence and gaining access.
Well, we're gonna leave it there, but I appreciate your helping us sort through all this and helping us think about it. And, you know, this is a conversation that I have a feeling you and I are happy with.
Right.
But everybody will find something to be outraged about with this conversation, no matter who it is.
I hope so.
Yeah, then it's fun, you know. And you know, they say they swear they'll never listen again. But they can't help themselves. They got to come back. They've got to come back and see what's being said around here.
Right.
So thanks again, Paul. We'll got to get you back when your new book comes out.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your very nice blurb for my book.
My pleasure. Thanks again. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. When I mentioned that Paul Gottfried holds a PhD from Yale, that actually reminded me, I am speaking at Yale April 4th at the Yale Political Union. So if you'd like to come see me, then please do that. The details are at tomwoods.com/events. That's April 4th, 2017. People do listen to these episodes sometimes away in the future. I don't want you to show up April 4th, 2018. There's some social justice warrior there and you're going to be very disappointed. So tomwoods.com/events will have details about that. I'm going to be in Seattle in May. Then there is a major Mises Institute event going on in October in New York City. So I got all that stuff up at tomwoods.com/events. I actually think I'm doing something in Orlando August 31st, so you might want to save the date for that. So lots of fun stuff. I always have that stuff up at tomwoods.com/events. All right, that's going to do it for this week. See you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.